Let's get a sense of the audience. Okay. So how many of you are parents of complex kids?
Okay. Awesome.
How many of you are professionals who work with parents who have complex kids?
Also awesome. How many of you are educators? Okay. Therapists? Social workers? Okay. How many of you might be complex adults yourself? Maybe? Just a few? Okay.
We're going to try to make the learning a little interactive today, which will help some of you who have that 2:45 energy shift or who have learning differences as well, and so we'll keep it easy for you.
Okay. So we're talking about parenting through the hot spots. That was weird.
That was really weird.
Am I not on mic? I am. So, Diane, you need to get
I need closer. To stand closer to the mic.
So
I'm good.
In the last 2 days, if you've learned nothing else by now, you probably know that raising complex kids is different from raising neurotypical kids. And we like to call them complex kids because whether you're here because you have a kid with ADHD or not, more than likely, at least 50% of those kids, probably more like 85% of those kids, have something else going on as well. So whether it's anxiety, depression, learning disabilities, autism, whatever else is going on, these kids are complicated. They struggle with life and learning or some combination thereof, right?
So we've been doing this work for almost 10 years, and as we've been working with parents all over the globe, what we've found is that there's some common challenges that parents face. And the most common are mornings, homework, bedtime, technology.
I was laughing when I was listening to Dr. Green this morning.
Yeah.
Because the same exact examples that he brought up are the same examples that we use all the time, because teeth brushing, no matter how old your kids, is one of the number one issues that parents complain about. I don't care if your kid is 6 or 16.
Right.
Right?
Or 20.
Right. Or something. Getting off technology. How many people in the room has never struggled with that?
Nobody has any problems with technology?
Right? Never struggle with it.
No.
Okay.
So who are we? What are we all about? This is me. I'm here with my two young adult kids who are now 18 and 20. I was one of those type A, get it done professional moms, worked in corporate for 23 years, and found that I was blessed with these wonderful, quirky kids, and found myself getting a lot really frustrated. I didn't quite understand why I couldn't get them to do what I needed them to do, couldn't understand that their brain didn't work the same way as mine, and spent a lot of time saying, why can't they just whatever it was.
Right. And I'm Elaine Taylor Klaus. I am the mom in an ADD plus family of five. Each of us was diagnosed one after the other, kind of like dominoes, right? And at some point, I looked at my husband, who's here with me today, and said, you cannot be responsible for all of this neurology. And eventually, I was diagnosed as well. So it's a family game in our house, and it keeps things exciting and interesting and challenging. And unlike Diane, I was not executive function mom. I was what I called lost mom. I had been struggling to raise three complex kids for about a decade, and I felt like I had lost myself. And I had been able to manage life pretty well when it was just me. And then I was okay when it was just a marriage. But when I started having kids, by the third one, it kind of put me over the edge. And it took me a long time to get a sense of what was really going on with me and regain my equilibrium. And part of what really helped me do that, which we're going to talk about today, is I discovered this fabulous world of coaching and a new way of being with an old problem.
Well, and what Elaine and I found when we met one another at a CHAG conference in 2010 was that we both became coaches and it changed the family dynamic. And so what we do all day, every day, is help parents by teaching them coaching tools, and we also work with educators. And we mostly help them go from a sense of desperation
to a
sense of inspiration.
Right.
And we teach what we call a coach approach to parenting. Where is it?
Try this.
That one? That'll work.
Yay. Yeah.
She's not a Mac person. We're training her. We're grooming her to learn to use a Mac. Okay.
So we're talking about the coach approach.
Yeah. So the idea behind it, so how many people here have some experience with coaching, either for yourselves, for your kids, and some professionally, whatever environment? So, and how many people have experience with therapy? And some are right. Okay. So a lot more. So a lot of us have this sort of sense of, well, what is coaching and how is it different from therapy and how is it similar? And what we learned, or what I learned early in this process, is that there is a role for both in managing the complex issues that we're facing. And that coaching was particularly well suited to understand what was going on with the issues and then move them forward. So the analogy I like to use is, if you came to me as an adult and said, I never learned to ride a bike, a consultant might tell you how to ride a bike. A therapist might spend some time trying to help you figure out why you never learned to ride a bike, and the coach would hold the bike steady while you climb on and run along beside you until you're riding the bike, right? So coaching is very much an active method for being with you and giving you the skills that you need to think about the challenges you're facing or the problems that you're having and coming up with really solutions that will work for you and your family. Not some solution somebody handed you on a piece of paper, but the actual, based on what's going on in your family dynamic, it's a method for problem solving that's personalized to your experience.
Well, and the piece about this is about the coach approach to parenting. And so as Dr. Green was talking about this morning, this is about collaborating with our kids to help them become increasingly more successful. And taking a coach approach really puts you in that different kind of position. It's really easy as parents, we know how to tell our kids what to do. We have this vision of us, of our kids being independent someday, but it's that place in the middle where you're helping them to do things more independently and increasingly more independently, which is really the magic space in between.
Right. The goal in parenting is to transfer ownership from us to them. Right. We don't want them to grow up with us being the experts on their lives. We actually want them to become the experts on their lives. And there's a process that we use as we're transferring that ownership. And we're going to give you some tools for that today, some ways to think about it.
So one of the most important questions we ask as coaches and as parents is, what is going on? Getting curious is an amazing tool that helps us to figure out where is our child right now and what is it that's making it hard for them to behave the way they want to, behave in a way that feels good for us, and or change their behavior.
Well, one of the things Dr. Green was talking about this morning, remember when he talked about asking your kids, like the best person to go to find out what's really going on, is to check in with their kids. And so we're looking at not just what do we know structurally that's going on, but really asking the question, what's happening for our kids from their experience as well? Not just from ours as parents or as teachers, but what is this kid dealing with? Because their perspective will help us lead to problem solving that will work for them.
Well, and the thing I want to add to that is that there's lots and lots of things going on for our kids. So if you have a kid who's being rude or talking back or having a hard time with their homework, it's easy to kind of look at the child and say, this is what's going on. And the reality is that there's probably six or seven things that are making it hard for them to get their homework done or making it hard for them to speak respectfully. And so when we're staying in that place of curiosity and really looking at what are all the things that might be going on for the child, enables us to tackle it from lots of different angles, which is really what our kid needs to help them to move forward.
So we've got four themes that we identified that we're going to talk about today on
we said
some level.
Mornings, homework, technology, and bedtime.
Right? Common themes everybody deals with in their homes. What's the theme, single theme that weaves them all together?
There's one thing that connects them all.
They're all transitions. Right? They're all transitions. And we know that our kids tend to struggle with transitions, stopping, transitioning, starting something else, whether it's putting a pencil down at the end of a test, moving out the door to go to school. It doesn't matter when it is. Transitions tend to be difficult.
Stopping showering and starting to get their pajamas on. You know, all
right.
of those things are transitions. So what is it that makes transitions hard for the ADHD brain?
Hyperfocus. Okay, so I can't stop because I'm really fixated on something.
What else? Distractibility.
Something else over here? I heard distractibility. Getting started.
Just getting started on something
right?
new.
Initiating a task.
No concept of time.
I used to say to my kids, there are two times in my house. There is now and not now. There was kind of nothing else, right?
I don't have to get out of the shower now.
It's not fun. Right?
It's hard. It's hard to do anything that's not fun. Right? Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Doesn't have a compelling purpose for them. So, yeah. And what I'll add to that is there's kind of nothing in it for them often, right?
Yeah. It's if it's boring, they have a hard time getting their brain to do it. Yep.
Right. Every day you expect me to do this twice a day? Are you kidding me?
This is no fun.
How boring is that?
Even the song that we sing is just no longer any fun.
Right. So these are all the kinds of things that make it hard for our brains, for our kids' brains, to go through these just typical, everyday, boring, run-of-the-mill transitions.
And what you're talking about is executive function, right? And this is what we've been talking about yesterday, and we're going to talk about the rest of the week. But underneath all of these pieces of transition success is executive function, and we know that these kids are challenged in executive function. So that's really what makes it hard, is that shifting from one thing to another requires an enormous amount of executive function.
Which is all happening up here in that sort of developed frontal lobe of the brain. Just a show of hands, how many people here know something about executive function? You've been to workshops, you actually understand the concept decently well.
Okay.
Really helpful. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to say the other part of that is shifting from the present to having some forethought and anticipating the future. If I don't brush my teeth, how is this going to impact me down the road? And that, again, is not something that is intrinsically needed to be kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. An 8-year-old is definitely not wondering whether they're going to get braces or whether they're going to get
cavities.
Cavities, that's the word. Told you this time of the afternoon. Right. Right. Yeah. And I mean, let's be honest, I'm 55 years old, and I still have to force myself to brush my teeth twice a day. And I even like the way it feels, right? But it's boring. So I have ways and mechanisms that I use to get myself to do it, but at 10, 15 years old, that may not have been an easy sell, right?
So should we do a 2-minute commercial on executive function just for the few folks in the room that... Just
yeah.
Quickly.
Okay, we'll do it.
So really,
the summary
super
version.
Duper fast. If the brain was an orchestra, executive function would be the conductor. It's the part of the brain that helps us do literally everything.
Think, feel, act, right?
Think, everything we think, everything that we feel, everything that we do is controlled by the part of our brain, which is in the frontal lobe, which is called the executive function.
And it's the part of the brain that tends to be developmentally delayed in kids with ADHD, anxiety, and some of the other coexisting conditions that come along with it.
Their executive function could be as much as 3 to 5 years behind their same age peers. So even if a child is gifted and super duper smart, maybe reading at college level in 5th grade, it's a different part of their brain.
Well, and what I will add to that is that they're 3 to 5 years behind their same age peers in some aspects of their development, but not all.
Right.
And that's key because that's what confuses us. Because we think if they can do this, why can't they do that, right? If my kid can argue with me at the dinner table and come up with fabulous arguments about why
they're practically lawyers, right?
Why can't they remember to take their backpack to school, right? Or put something in their backpack? And it's this disconnect because we do kind of equate organized with smart.
And
but
the two are
different. In
fact,
they're very, very different.
Well, and the other piece of it is not always the same from day to day. You talked about motivation and interest and all these other things that make it easier for these kids and for their brains to engage. I was listening to Dr. Green this morning and about shifting expectations and setting expectations appropriately. The challenge is that some days these kids do it, and then tomorrow they can't. And so you're like, well, do I set the expectation based on this one day that they were able to do it, or do I set it based on the fact that they can't? And we get kind of stuck in the middle. And the reality is that this waxing and waning is a natural part of ADHD, and we don't talk about it a lot.
Well, and even if we understand it, very, very often your kids' teachers won't. Hmm. And so we may get it, and we may be able to set appropriate expectations, but if a teacher sees a kid do something once or twice, they now have the expectation.
They're going to do it all the time.
Understandably. Right, that they're going to be able to do it. And then when they can't the next week because they had a fight on the playground or a fight in the morning, the teacher doesn't yet know how to make that connection. For those of you in the back, there's plenty of room on the floor. If you're a sitter on the floor, there's plenty of room up here. Please come on in.
Yeah.
Okay.
6 areas of executive function. We're not going to go through all 6 of them in detail at all. Activation or task management, action management, memory or information management.
Closer to the mic.
Focus or attention management, Emotion management and effort management. Right. So all of these are areas that these kids can have some developmental delays in.
And this is all based on the research that was done by Dr. Tom Brown when he was at Yale, where he identified these six key areas as part of the ADHD syndrome. Yeah. Prioritization comes
it's in tests.
Is it, no, it's an org, it's an information management.
Yes,
if I believe, if I remember, or action management. It kind of shows up in a couple of different places.
Effort management is about keeping your energy going. It's about either slowing down or speeding up, depending on what your challenge is.
Sometimes we use Dr. Mark Burton, who's here this week, does a lot of work with this as well. And we shift between effort management and energy management for that one because people kind of connect with that language a little differently.
If you are interested, and I'm going to pause the conversation, but we have a chart that has lots of things listed under each one of
the
these, so it gives you a
different
sense of where it fits. It ultimately doesn't matter where it fits because these kids have some challenges. They might have two things under activation and three things under focus. It's really about understanding that if your child's having a challenge, chances are it goes back to some executive function. So let's talk back to transitions and the fact that transitions rely on executive functions. So we took a minute and said, okay, what are the ones that we think are the most challenging for these kids? And we decided that we would focus on shifting attention, which is one of the attention ones, working memory, frustration tolerance, and something we call self-regulation that we'll talk about in a little bit more detail.
That's that ability to inhibit action, right? And all six areas of executive function are impacted in transitions, but we wanted to just sort of hone in a little bit on these four.
Okay, so shifting attention. So this is, what should we call him? Steve?
Okay.
Does he look like Steve?
That works fine.
Steve's playing his video games, and Mom's yelling upstairs, hey, Steve, dinner time in 5 minutes. Make sure you're done with your game so you can come downstairs. Steve doesn't even realize that Mom said anything until after she's already gone back to cooking dinner. And then he's like, wait, was that Mom? What was she saying? She must have been talking to the dog. And he goes back to playing his game.
Okay. So working memory is that ability to hold information in your head while you're beginning to work on something else. So in a school environment, that might be doing math, where you're doing like long division, you have to remember something. At home, it might be
about remembering that you've got a list of things that you need to do.
Right.
And so I have homework, but yes, I did my homework, or I don't remember what it was. I don't know what I've already done.
I have this really great memory of walking into the laundry room, opening the dog bin, and finding a pair of socks. And the socks were there because my son was holding the socks when he went in to go feed the dog, because I interrupted him from one thing he was doing to go do another thing, and then the socks ended up in the dog food bin because I interrupted his working memory from doing one thing to another, right? Anybody ever found socks in the dog food? Yes. It can be tied into it. So if a kid doesn't pay attention, isn't able to hold that working memory and can transfer it into a longer-term memory, then it's gone. So they can have it in that moment, but if it doesn't get into that loop for a longer-term memory, that's probably
the important distinction is that there's a difference between memory and working memory. So working memory is what we do when we're trying to do long division and we're carrying the three and we're figuring out what the next step is and all those pieces. Memory is, oh yeah, and my kid does this all the time. No, last Tuesday, Mom, you wore your blue dress. So it's really not the same part of the brain. Okay, working memory, good?
Yep.
Okay. Frustration tolerance or emotion management. We talked this morning about the fact that if this control jumps in, these kids get frustrated. If a kid is surprised by the fact that, oh, I'm supposed to get off my technology, all of a sudden you're like, I told you 10 minutes ago you're supposed to be off. Now I'm going to just turn it off. I'm going to unplug it. Being able to manage that frustration and handle a difficult situation, handle conflict, is very limited in these kids.
Well, and this is what Tony Rossain was talking about last night, right? For a long time, we didn't even see a connection between emotionality and ADHD. And about, I guess it was now 10, 15 years ago, Dr. Barkley and others started identifying the link, and there was some research to indicate And now we know that emotional management is part of an executive function skill. And so that's why we know there's a connection and we're beginning to see it. But 10 years ago, if we had had this conversation, most of the medical practitioners in the room would have basically said, no, there's no relation. So this is a lot of new awareness that we're having.
And one of the important pieces about emotion management is that when any of us get triggered, whether we're ADHD or not, our access to our problem-solving part of our brain decreases because we go back into our emotional part of our brain. We go back into our amygdala. I'm mad at you, so I can't think straight. Have you ever had that moment where you're so angry you can't think straight? If you've got a diminished executive function in the first place and you get angry or frustrated, you have even less access to those creative problem-solving parts of your brain.
And then the last one is self-regulation. This falls in the realm of action because this is about the decision to or not to inhibit your action. So this is where impulsivity lies, right? That ability to know, no, I shouldn't do that is every much as part of whether I choose to do something. It's different sides of the same coin.
This is the kid who knows that they've only got 10 more minutes, but they go ahead and watch a 20-minute YouTube video because it's really cool and it was the next thing that popped up when the video they were watching is finished.
And they know they should stop, but it's like just a little bit more, and they click that button anyway, right? It's when you're reading at night, and you're going to read to the end of the chapter, and then you get to the end of the chapter, and you start reading the next chapter. Anybody ever had that happen, right? That's because that ability to inhibit the action is challenged.
So what are some of the things you notice about your mornings and your technology management and your homework that are tying into this executive function component?
How does it show up in your house?
All of the above, just like older.
Okay. All of the above.
I mean, I was just going to ask, if you don't mind interrupting, that how do you handle, since you have five people in your house, about, I'm going to stop at, Mom, let me finish this page.
Uh-huh.
Mom,
so the question is, how do you, when a kid says, I'm going to finish this page, and then three chapters later, they're still reading, right? So in our model, what we would talk about is taking aim. So that's a challenge that you're seeing. As Dr. Green would say, it's a behavior that's exhibiting, right? So we would take aim and problem solve around how do you get yourself to stop when it's hard to stop. What's important to him about stopping, if he says he's going to stop them, is it really important? There's a whole problem-solving thing that would happen around it. But what I don't want to do is take it personally and get upset because he told me he was going to stop and then he didn't, and so now I'm mad at him because he lied to me, right? He's not lying to me.
Not so much the lying, but it's like 10:45.
Yeah. Right. So let's hold that. We're going to have time for questions at the end, and we're going to talk next about some of the strategies you guys can put in place. But
yeah.
So I just want to get a sense. Does everybody really see this? Does this feel familiar? You can go, yeah, this is it. And what I want to challenge you to do is that when you see the challenging behavior, you don't focus on the behavior. You focus on the executive function challenge that's leading to the behavior because you can accommodate the executive function challenge in a different way than if you're just focused on getting them to get off the computer.
Yeah.
If you'd love to share one.
Well, the screen thing is huge.
Yep.
The screen switch.
Yeah. So
yeah.
No. And they
absolutely
think you can't see the change. So what she's saying is when she comes downstairs, when the kid's doing homework, and there's kind of a sneaky factor to the fact that they're supposed to be doing this, and you walk in, and you see the light flip on the screen, so you know that they've been doing something else.
Or he stands up. All of a sudden, he's always like, it seems like every time I come downstairs, something changes.
Ah, yeah. It's a way to get their attention, isn't it?
So a reframe on that is when you are present, his ability to stay focused on his work is different than when you're not in the room.
Right, and that's not saying...
No question. When
right.
you are present, his ability to stay focused on his work is different than when you're not in the room.
But
yep.
It does.
So if I were to just stay there the whole time, he might stay focused on...
Well, and I'm not saying that that's the appropriate solution, but the problem is his ability to stay focused on his schoolwork on the computer is
independently
different independently is different when there's someone present than when there's no one there. And so that can be a potential way to start looking at a solution.
And because what?
It could be because of impulse control. I mean, let's go back to the executive functions, distractibility, right? So he could be distracted by all the other stuff on his computer. Impulse control, he can't avoid it. I mean, so all of these things that are executive functions that make it hard to stay focused are easier for him when there's somebody there as a body double, as a second presence, whatever it is.
So I want to hold it because we're going to have a chance to come back to it, and I want to get through so we can go through the exercise of how does this show up.
Okay. But all everybody right. has a – is there anybody that doesn't yet have an identification with this?
Okay. Right. Good. So what can you do about this?
Right.
Right. And this is what we want to introduce to you. There's a coaching construct called the Wheel of Life, and we like to use it in a lot of different ways to help – introduce concepts or to teach tools that are easier to remember. So we use it kind of as a working memory tool.
So there are two aspects to this. There are some tools we're going to teach you that are focused on you as the parent or the adult that's working with the child, and then there are some that are focused specifically on the child. And it's important to kind of distinguish because if we have to change our kid, it feels much more difficult than if we can do something different that will help the child to change.
Well, and that goes back to what we've been hearing and what we heard this morning is that you can't really control what's going on with your child. You can't control your child. You can't control what happens. You can control how you respond to what happens.
And honestly, that's why we work with parents, because with rare exception, these kids aren't as interested in getting help as the parents are.
Right.
Okay, so things for you. This is the green side, right? So we're going to talk about four things. We're going to talk about prevention versus management. We're going to talk about expectations. We're going to talk about catastrophizing. And we're going to talk about reactivity. Focusing on both prevention and management. So if you think about mornings, for example, there's things that you can do while you're getting through your morning, and there are things you can do ahead of time to think about what makes it hard in the morning. So consciously being aware of the fact that, wow, maybe there are some parts of the process we could do the night before might take some pressure off the morning. That would be an example of prevention. Management might be, how do I make sure that I notice my child is distracted when they're upstairs getting their clothes on? If I notice every day they go upstairs and they fall into a black hole, part of what I might need to do is to intervene and engage because I know that they're going to get distracted.
So, and again, the focus here is on us, right?
We're taking action.
It is our job to create an environment that makes it possible for our kids to be successful based on the challenges that they're presenting with, the way that transitions are difficult for them. So rather than setting the expectation that may not be realistic and then getting frustrated because they're not hitting it, if we spend a little bit of time looking at how can we prevent some of the problems and or how can we manage them when they happen and deal with that differently, that enables us to be really successful. I'm thinking about a family I worked with who had a child that was having a really, really hard time getting out of bed in the morning. It wasn't waking up, but he wouldn't get out of bed. And we had gone through a lot of different strategies to try to prevent it and make sure he was getting sleep the night before and all of these things. And it finally became clear that it was a management issue, that he needed something to get him activated in the morning. And what we discovered is when they let the dog jump on the bed to wake him up, that gave him some activation, right? And then sometimes it was tickling from the dad. But this kid needed some intervention to help him manage the problem of being able to get out of bed.
Well, and then shifting that same example to prevention, another story is that actually with my son, we were working together on how to help him to get out of bed in the morning. And we sat and we brainstormed what are like 10 different things we could try over the next couple of weeks that might work. And we talked about the dog on the bed, and we talked about tickle fights, and we talked about crazy songs. But you're working together to think about what you might try. And I don't think we've said this enough, but I want to say this all the time. This is not about finding the solution that will work. This is about building your portfolio, your toolbox, so that you know today I'm going to try this, and maybe it'll work for a couple of days, and maybe you'll need to try something tomorrow. And so if you take pressure off yourself and off your child from finding the right answer, everything changes.
So this is about what this piece about prevention and management really has a lot of collaborative piece to it. So yes, there's some work for us to do, and we don't want to do it without doing it in collaboration with our kids. I was just thinking about a particular period of high school years where there was a spray bottle of water involved with getting out of bed, but it was not our idea. And that was key. In fact, my husband's in the back of the room. It was their idea. And there's one memory I'll never forget of literally him dragging her across the floor by her feet. She's holding onto the bed is moving across the room. Everybody is cracking up, right? Because it's not, this isn't a control game. She knew she needed to get out of bed, and she needed help to do it. And sometimes we had to make it a little more fun than others, you know? So the collaboration piece. Lesson learned.
Prevention and management.
Okay.
So the second piece for you is about expectations, and Dr. Green talked about this morning. I mentioned earlier the important thing about expectations is that sometimes these kids wax and wane. So what's possible for them today may not be possible for them tomorrow. I always say an expectation is realistic. If they can do it 80% of the time by themselves, that's a good expectation to set. If they can't, chances are you need to look at something a little less independent and accommodate there. So you want to make sure you're really clear on what's a reasonable expectation.
And the other thing I would add is we talk about this a little bit differently from Dr. Green, and I was talking to a physician earlier today who said, I can't tell my parents to lower their expectations. And I don't think that's what his intention is by any stretch. We talk about it in terms of shifting expectations. It's not lowering the bar. It's meeting them where they are.
And raising
the bar from there. Right? So we want to shift the expectations to where they are developmentally capable now and then begin to incrementally grow on that instead of holding the bar so high that they never feel like they can hit it.
Well, and that happens a lot of times as parents will say, well, all the other ninth graders can do this. Come on, get up here. You can do it. Let's go. But there's several steps between where they are and where their peers are behaving currently.
And this goes back to that 3 to 5 year developmental delay, right? If they have that developmental delay, we want to meet them where they are developmentally, not chronologically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just quickly, what I would say is, so the question is, if you have one child in the room that's neurodiverse and one that's neurotypical, not in the room, in your home, sorry, how do you handle the different expectations for the different kids if the younger child in particular has more capacity? And the answer is that you meet the kids where they are and that you set the expectations. What I used to say to my kids all the time is, I'm gonna meet your needs. You're going to get what you need based on what you need, and it's not going to necessarily be the same as what your brother or sister needs.
Fair does not necessarily mean the same.
Right. And so we really want to bring them into the conversation about this is reasonable for you and try to let go of that tendency to compare, because it's not a fair comparison.
Well, and the other thing that can be really helpful is to focus on different things with your child. So if you've got one that's working on X, because one that's working on getting dressed independently, and the other one might be working on getting their bed made. You know, so it's if you're working on different things with the kids, there's less focus on the fact that the expectations are different.
The other thing I want to say about that, just because you brought it up and it's a good time to do it, is I'm thinking about one family I work with where the younger daughter had pretty significant ADHD and was having a lot of trouble getting almost anything done. The older daughter had pretty significant anxiety, and so she was getting everything done, right? And the parents thought she was perfect, and there was nothing wrong with her, except for they were completely missing the fact that she was having these huge emotional blow-ups and meltdowns because she was frustrated by the younger sister. But the expectation was unrealistic for because they were looking at the younger sister only in terms of the task performance, and they weren't holding this older child accountable for the emotional management, right? And so when we started taking aim on that older child's emotional management, it actually released some of the triggers that were happening in the home, because they kept looking at the younger ADD kid and saying she was the problem, and the kid isn't the problem. Right, as we've learned, the behaviors are the problem that indicate that there's a communication a problem that needs to be solved. Yeah. Right.
Okay. The next one for you is about catastrophizing, and we love this word. We say it all the time. This is the fear that, oh my gosh, they can't, you know, talk respectfully to me. They're going to lose their job when they're 30 because they're going to yell at their boss, or they're going to be living on my couch when they're 27 years old. And we go there, right? It's really easy to look at their behavior currently and say, there's no out, there's no up from here, this is never going to change. And when we do that, we go into triggered mode. If we get scared, our ability to problem solve is just as challenged as if we get angry. So it's important to kind of check ourselves and say, okay, I've got enough time. I've got, you know, even if it's only a year, I can't tell you how many parents I talked to in the junior year of high school. It's like, I've got one more year before my kid has to go off to college. What do I do? You've got time, and each child's going to be on their own trajectory. If you stay focused on what's going on now and not worrying about the future, you're going to be much more successful.
So have you ever walked into your family room and found, like, crumbs on the floor or wrappers, and you start thinking this kid's never going to be able to take care of an apartment, they're never going to be living independently.
They're going to live in squalor.
Right. This is what we mean by catastrophizing. And we do it to ourselves, right? This is the story we make up and we tell ourselves. And when we tell ourselves, as Diane said, we get triggered, which is actually the next area.
Yep.
And it doesn't serve them or us. So part of in coaching, we talk about reframing, making up a new story. When we tend towards catastrophizing, part of the management is telling ourselves another story that could also be true. So it might be true that they can't handle their apartment at 24, but what could also be true? It could be true that they were distracted. It could be true that I called them and they didn't do anything before I asked them to leave the room. Like, there are a lot of other things that could also be true that can help us manage our anxiety.
So instead of going to the catastrophizing, go to, wow, isn't it really interesting that he still needs help or she still needs help cleaning up after herself? How can I focus in on that and help her to change her behavior so that when she's living independently, she's more likely to notice and to do it on her own?
Right.
Managing your own reactivity. So this is the other side of this. So fear is the catastrophizing. Reactivity is the frustration and anger. We've got to focus in on our own reactivity. Again, we have to stay in problem-solving mode so that we can help our kids stay calm and that we can continue to move the situations forward.
Anybody here confess to ever yelling at a kid? Just curious. Anybody ever find yourself crying, hiding in a closet? Okay, like,
all of those are reactions, right?
Right?
Normal.
This is human.
Yeah, well, and this is frustrating stuff. My gosh, you tell your kids 17 times to get out of the shower. I mean, it's going to be headbanging at some point.
So managing our own stuff is essential to helping our kids learn to manage theirs, not only because it will manage keep calm prevailing in the home and allow us to problem solve, but it's also modeling it for them. Right. If they see us losing our cool and they start to get the message, the way you get people to do things is by screaming, well, what are they going to start doing?
Yeah.
Right? Or hiding or avoiding, whatever it is. They're going to model the behaviors. They're not going to model the behaviors you want them to model. Right? They're going to model the ones you don't.
Right.
So paying attention to how we react is really essential.
So we're going to do a quick exercise. And we just learned a new word for this. This is a turn and talk.
Turn and talk.
So you're going to turn and you're going to talk to the person next to you and you're going to share with them just a few minutes of what are the things that trigger you and what helps you to avoid reacting when you're triggered. So.
And groups of two, three, whatever, whoever's next to you, just take about 2 minutes.
Turn and talk.
And talk to each other about when do you get triggered and what helps you handle the reaction.
You think we're doing good on time? I think we are.
I want to be done by 10:30.
10 till to have time?
We're done at 3. Is that right?
4.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Top of the hour.
To 45 to 4.
I think we're doing really, really well.
Yeah. No idea. I wanna.
My water.
I don't have a second hand on my watch, and it is killing me.
Well, it's. Oh, there's not a second hand there either. It's going by seconds there. We've been going for a.
I just don't know how long.
3:26. Oh. So.
One or two.
Well, and maybe we just, how about if we debrief by saying, this is universal. You guys obviously are all experiencing this, and I bet nobody had. I bet there's no one in the room that didn't
maybe
have something.
Maybe, you know, it's one thing that helps with the trigger, just the bottom line.
Oh, so what, does it help to unravel from the trigger?
Yeah.
All right, let's come back.
Can we call you back?
Is this really working?
It's not working that well.
All right. Let's bring it back.
No, it's just blowing on it.
So, see, it's really difficult to transition from a conversation back to quiet because you want to be active and engaged and talking, and so transitioning can be so hard, can't it? So just like three people just bottom
Well, wait,
line,
before you do
word.
That, one of the things I want to say is that this is universal, right? Nobody had a hard time finding something to talk about, did they? How many of you like could have talked
triggered.
All day about your triggers, right?
Right, and it may be with your kids, it may be with your partner, it may be with your boss. I mean,
maybe with yourself.
Right, oh yeah, we deal with it all the time. So what do you use to manage it? Right.
Like,
what
let's hear three things.
Yeah.
We have a behavioral therapist in our home 4 days a week.
Okay, so I'm asking you, though. I want
what
to
do
change
you
the question.
Do?
What do you do to manage when you're feeling like you're about to lose it?
I go to Target.
So
retail therapy.
Okay.
So that's
we call this, there's a technical term for this. It's called retail therapy.
Retail therapy,
okay.
and escape, right?
Right?
So those two things are tools for you. What
okay,
about you
yeah.
in the back?
I
need space. I need to go
taking
cool off.
Taking a time out. Calm down. Another
Mommy
thing.
Needs time out.
Yeah.
Oh, so you ask them to give
right?
you space.
Go.
How
go can
away.
I miss you if you won't go away? Yeah.
Oh, so getting really loud and
I love it. Singing opera. Did you were pointing. Okay. All right. One more. Last one. Almond M&Ms. So stress eating is not. I'm not going to recommend it, but I can see where it comes from.
Some people have metabolisms that can tolerate that.
There was somebody on the floor back there. Hold that thought.
Okay. That's
we're coming
great,
back to
yeah.
that. The strategy she suggested is empathizing. We'll be back. Great transition. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll pay you later.
Okay.
You
do
you,
oh, I was just going to say, I have like a mantra in my head. This is not an emergency.
Love that.
Love
so
that.
This is not an emergency. That's a great, great tool because what's happened when you get triggered is your brain says, this is terrible. The world's going to end. I must fix this right now. And so if you can say this is not an emergency and take a deep breath, you can unravel from it differently.
So we do a training program for professionals. We teach a class called Sanity School, right, for parents and teachers. And we train local providers to teach that
course, in their local communities. And we were just doing a training earlier this week before the conference. And part of what we were talking about is that oftentimes when parents come to us, they think they're in crisis. They're telling themselves they're in crisis. And 9 times out of 10, they're actually not.
We have a lot of parents who really are in
crisis. Sometimes they are. I mean, for real, like we all have those days and moments and things that happen that really are a crisis. But most of the time, we create this sense of crisis in our brain that may not really be. And so I love this notion of a mantra that this is not a crisis. I can handle it. I used to say, I got this, right?
Well, and the piece of it is that if we raise our energy because we're overwhelmed and we don't know what to do, it helps us to feel like we're accomplishing something. Right. Yelling at our kids feels better than not knowing what to do for a lot of us, right? And so you yell, and then you feel a little bit better. Your problem still
has that later,
but your problem still hasn't been solved. But you've raised your energy, which for most of us feels pretty good. Well, and honestly, that's an interesting comment. What you're saying is that
repeat the comment.
The comment was that talking calmly, a lot of times it goes on deaf ears, and it just nothing happens.
And so you have to get louder and louder to get their attention.
So part of the challenge with the trigger piece of it is that raising your voice does sometimes work. But are you raising your voice, or are you losing your cool? And those are two different things. Fair?
Well, and the other question I would say is, are you getting short-term results or long-term? Are you getting it done but not teaching them to do it on the long-term? And that's really what we're moving into is
well,
how
and we
you
talk,
to shift that.
Sorry, we talk about motivation and what are the things that motivate. And one of them is we call it hurry up, right? It's that sense of urgency. And so when you're afraid that you're going to get in trouble, you're motivated in a different way than if you're not afraid that you're going to get in trouble. The challenge with that is that it's not sustainable. What we're trying to do is help our kids to figure out what motivates their brain. And I've got 55-year-old moms that the only way they can get themselves to do anything is by beating themselves up because they're not getting it done. That's because they haven't really learned how to figure out how to make their brain motivated other than getting in trouble.
So there's a question here, and then we're going to move on. I'm going to.
That's not losing my cool. It's I'm telling them.
Okay.
The fourth time.
Yeah.
Going to be a much firmer voice. They're like, don't yell at someone.
So let me stop you and repeat it for the recording. So what she's saying is that it's exactly what Diane was saying. It's not losing your cool. It's very clearly communicating clear expectations in advance. If I have to ask a fourth time, I'm going to get louder because it's hard to get your attention. That's not coming from a place of losing it and reactivity. It's a conscious discussion conversation where you're setting an expectation with a clear consequence in advance and communicating it in advance. But I want to move on for the moment. We can come back to it. I don't want to get derailed on how do you handle that one
and
issue.
And I want to just put a commercial in for the difference between calm and fake calm.
Anybody know what we mean by fake calm? My husband's raising his hand. I just want the record to reflect.
Just because I can modulate my voice and talk very calmly does not mean that I'm not incensed inside my head. Okay,
right.
So we're talking about managing your reactivity. Just talking quietly doesn't get you unraveled from a trigger.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to talk about...
We do a lot of work on help you get unraveled from triggers. So if you want more on that, not this workshop, but come back later.
Lots of work on it. We're going to move over to the right-hand side of the wheel and talk about the blue stuff, which is about focusing on your kids. Four areas. We're going to talk about collaboration. We're going to talk about buy-in. We're going to talk about failing forward. And we're going to talk about something we call ACE.
Using ACE. Okay, so... How many people were at the workshop this morning with Dr. Green?
The keynote.
So most of you. So you got a good sense of what collaboration is about. The goal in collaboration is to bring your kid into a sense of control and participation, not to do for them or to them, but to bring them into the discussion because this is their issue. Whatever it is they're doing that's driving you crazy is ultimately theirs to learn to manage, not yours to force to manage.
Well, and the distinction here is that we're really not focused on hanging up the towel in the bathroom.
Okay, maybe we are a little bit.
It's really not about hanging up the towel. It's about remembering that a job's not done until it's done, whether it's the towel or the stuff on the counter in the kitchen. It's a you want your child to learn the process of knowing when they are complete in doing a task and what their brain needs to be successful in remembering to complete that task, right? So you want to focus on working with them, and you honestly want to reward and celebrate the working on it part even more than the hanging up the towel, if that makes sense.
We talk about it in terms of focusing on the process over the outcome, right? Because these are kids who struggle with process. They struggle with learning to put systems in place for themselves and follow through. So we really want to acknowledge and bring them into the process of problem solving, because that's what's going to give them the skills to be able to do that for the rest of their lives and not just get the towel hung up. Although I will say, I really love it when that towel is hung up. I mean, it feels like an accomplishment.
Well, and I have parents who actually have reward systems in place for weekly meetings talking about how things are going, right? So it's that sort of, you want to inspire and motivate the cooperation and the collaboration.
You have a question.
You're saying problem solving and collaboration. Then doesn't the kid have to agree that, hey, this is a problem and I'm not putting my towel up? If it doesn't think it's a problem, why is he even going through the process?
Bingo, move to the next one.
Next slide. Yeah,
so absolutely. The question raised was, is if the kid doesn't see it as a problem, is can he really collaborate? And to some extent, the answer is no, right? You may have to help them find a reason to see it as a problem or a motivation to do it. There may be some other factors involved. But at the end of the day, if you want to teach your kids the process of problem solving, you'll continue to focus on this effort of getting buy-in, which may mean choosing things to care about that they might care about too, starting with them.
Well, and actually parents come to us all the time and they have no idea where to start, because let's face it, these kids have 17 challenges or 700 challenges. It's not just one. And the towel on the floor, they may not care about at all. And so we encourage parents to take aim on something that the child wants to see changed, even if it's just, I want mom to get off my back about this whole thing about the towel, so yeah, I'll work with you on it.
Parents come a lot to us and say, I want to get my kid to clean their room. How many people here want your kids to clean their room? Okay. So what if I told you cleaning their room is not important to them? It's amorphous and huge, because cleaning their room could be about 70 different tasks, right? And
their definition of clean is different than your
definition.
Totally
different. So what's really important about it? And if you can get underneath it to figure out, what do you really want? And sometimes you just want them to do something that looks like they're taking care of something, anything, right? But when we hold on to this should, that my kids should clean their room because that means I'm a good parent, that's a whole different place than, you know, my kid who can't find anything and I want to help them get their room to a place where at least they feel like they can find their homework. We used to have a room in my house that was, if you want us to come in and say goodnight, there will be a clean path from the door to the bed, because I don't want to get killed falling over something in the dark. I'm not kidding you. And when we let go of this need for them to clean their room, this part of this came from Hal Runkle. He wrote a book called Scream-Free Parenting that wasn't so perfect for complex kids, but it had some great stuff in it. And this notion that their need to clean the room, they didn't care about it. And when I could let go of that and figure out what they did care about, and they cared about me coming in to say goodnight, actually. That was important to them.
And so that was a motivation for them,
right,
to work with you to make some changes in their room cleanliness.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
This may be the wrong comment related to this set. Even for this conference. But this is a real question. A child with ADHD, are they somehow biologically or psychologically incapable of simply obeying their parents?
That is a great question. The question is a child with ADHD biologically incapable of obeying their parents?
Well, and what you're really asking is, you know, how often are they externally motivated, right? And so
are they going to do it just because you said so?
Yeah, because I said so.
Okay, so here's the answer. No. They're not going to do it just because you said so.
They're going to do it.
And yes, they are biologically, neurologically wired not to have the chemicals operating in the brain that they need to find the motivation they need to follow your direction just because you said
is
so.
It's different. Well, hang on a second. Elaine, I think you want to reframe that just slightly because it sounds like they're not able to, and they can.
I need you to say that again so I can record it for my mother-in-law.
Well, it's on the recording.
So
I wish I could. Hold on a second.
So
Wait. Because yeah. I don't want to derail, and yeah. I want to watch our time. And I really respect the question because it's a question a lot of people in the room
And it's
have.
Not just – it's not neurobiological kids versus – or.
Right.
Neurotypical versus non-neurotypical. The reality is that every child's ability to be motivated by something is different. You may have a child who really does want to follow the rules. You may have a child who wants to follow the rules because they're a pleaser. You may have a child who wants to follow the rules because they're afraid of getting into trouble. And there's nothing wrong with that, although what I was talking about earlier is this whole sustainability if you're managing your household by fear, right? So these kids are going to have, at some point, they're going to get burned out by it.
And hit 14 and then...
And because of their executive function challenges, and particularly their challenges of working memory, as an ADHD kid, I'm not going to remember that I'm going to get in trouble if I don't do this thing that you asked me to do. And that's the thing that's different and important, is that they don't remember the same way. They don't learn from their mistakes the same way because their working memory doesn't work the same way as neurotypical kids do.
So they're... I want to try to keep it as short as I can, but the bottom line to what you're asking are they incapable? And the answer is that it's not that they're not capable. It's that there have to be certain conditions in place to help them practice that capacity. And they may not have the skills developed yet
to
be able to just do whatever it is you ask, because there are so many different, hold on a second, if you will, so many different aspects of executive function that are at play with these kids. You know, we showed you that chart with the 6 different executive functions. Obeying or following a direction could involve all 6 aspects of executive function. And so even if they want to follow the direction and they have a motivation to, they still may not be able to, depending on what other factors are going on. And so if we assume best intention that they want to, but that it's hard for them to obey or follow directions or do what's being asked of them, then we can problem solve to help them figure out what would make it possible for them to address whatever it is you're asking them to do.
What?
So one of the things we talk about is it naughty? Or is it neurological?
Right. And so if you have a child who you think is behaving in a naughty fashion, you're going to respond in a certain way. And I'm not going to be really focused on helping them develop a skill. I'm going to be punishing. I'm going to be getting angry, all of those sorts of things. But if I can shift my perspective and say, this is a child who's having a really hard time showing respect right now. Mm-hmm. How can I help them? I'm in a place of helping. And my energy shifts. And their ability to problem solve and collaborate with me is going to be different. Maybe not in that moment because they're probably triggered. But when I say, wow, I noticed that you were really upset yesterday. What should I do when you get upset? Is there something that we could do that would help you to not use such words that feel really mean to me? Those sorts of things will shift the energy. But I want to take us back here for a minute. This is about buy-in. And the bottom line here is that if you're having a hard time getting your child to collaborate, chances are it's because they don't have an interest in changing the behavior.
And that's key to actually getting it done. There are two more focusing on the kids that we want to focus on. One is called failing forward, and this is the notion of making it okay to make mistakes and helping them learn how to learn from mistakes without feeling shame or embarrassment around it. And we could do an entire workshop on just this topic. It's a really complex issue, I understand. But we want to introduce this notion. We tend to teach the magic 3 questions when something doesn't go the way you want, right? What worked? What didn't work? What do you want to do differently? But always start with what worked. Start with a positive construct. Start with some way of helping them see. Because even if they bombed out on a test, maybe what worked was that they studied with a friend for it, right? Something positive to get them in a positive framework before you look at what didn't work.
Well, a lot of times parents will come to me and I'll say, we'll talk about ideas and suggestions, and they'll say, oh, I tried that didn't work. And so I'm never going to try it again. And our kids get into the same idea. Or I asked my child what they think I should do, and they said, I don't know. So the point here is that you want to pay attention to what, learn from what didn't work, instead of just saying it didn't work.
Right. So we call it failing forward. It's sort of a classic coaching construct. And the framework for that in the home in particular is to make it okay to make mistakes. Right? And it's really hard because we get perfectionist. We cover up our own mistakes. We call out on the slightest little things, and we don't even realize we're doing it. But as you've heard throughout the conference, these kids are redirected and corrected 70 times more than their peers. What was it, 70,000 more we heard yesterday in a presentation over the course of a lifetime of their childhood? So when we can let go of the little stuff and allow them to learn to fail forward in life, and to give them to forgive themselves for making mistakes, it's a different environment for them.
The last one is something we call ACE, and this is a tool that I love to teach parents because it's a really good way to stay in that space of collaboration. We want to acknowledge, we want to show compassion, and then we want to explore. So many times as parents, we want to jump to the solution. Okay, I got this problem. Let's do this. You didn't get your homework done. Well, if you'd use your planner, or if we, why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? If we start with compassion and say, wow, I know that was really hard for you. I bet you were really upset when you got that grade on your test. How did that feel? I know that I get upset when I don't do as well as I'd like to. If you give the kids a chance to kind of connect with you and to unravel from their own triggers, it puts them in a place where you can then say, so what do you want to try? What should we do about it? What do you want to do about it? That's the explore piece.
So an example of using ACE, and this is a tool that, that our parents use a lot because it's just sort of universally useful. I used it all the time to help my kid get the trash out. I mean, just simple stuff, right? But you can also use it when it's time to start homework. I get that you're having a great time playing, and I know that it's frustrating to have to stop what you're doing and start doing homework. I know that when I'm doing something I love and I have to do something I kind of have to do, I don't want to do it, and I don't blame you. Can we talk about some strategies? Let's talk about how what might help you stop playing the video game so you can get to your homework. Right?
That's Does this A-C-E, tool make sense?
Really.
It's an important precursor to collaboration.
And what we talk about a lot is that you may spend a lot of time in the A and the C. You may spend way more time acknowledging and compassion, acknowledge with compassion, before you get to explore options. And if they start getting triggered, then you want to go back to the acknowledgement.
When it's really easy to go, I bet you're upset about this, but you got to get your homework done.
Right.
So you want to stay in that A and C as long as you can so the kids, again, unravel from the trigger, get them back into a place of problem solving. So I want to skip over this.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So
can we just check in for questions on
it
then?
Yep. Exactly. So
we've had an exercise.
Everybody, ACE makes sense to everybody? And can you see how you could build it into your toolbox? Okay. Great.
Okay.
So these are the 8 things that we're going to focus in on. There's 4 of them for you, 4 of them for your kid. Focusing on both prevention and management, shifting expectations, stopping catastrophizing, managing your own reactivity, focusing on collaboration, getting buy-in, failing forward, and using ACE.
And the key thing here is to remember that some of the strategies you're going to develop and use to help you manage these issues have not much to do with your kid. And it's really about focusing on yourself.
Which is empowering and frustrating all
and
at the same time.
And notice all the strategies that have to do with your kid also have to do with you. Right? At the end of the day, you're the one that's setting the stage, that's setting the tone of the home. You're the one that's creating the environment for them to be successful at that point of performance, whatever that performance is that you're looking for.
Well, and that's why behavior management training for parents is recommended treatment for these kids, because you are the ones that are best suited to help them change their behavior. And you have to do things differently in order to create the environment where they can do that.
Yeah. So do you want to, let's take one example?
Yeah.
We have time. We have about 10 minutes left or so. We can do Q&A, or we can take one of the, take what we've been talking about today and use it as an example and sort of take it through. So I think we're going to start with that, and then we'll see if there's some.
So does anybody have a morning or a technology or a bedtime?
One example
that we can kind of look at this. and apply one of the tools. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How old is your son? 11-year-old son kicking holes in the wall.
So let's start with getting curious. What's going on? What are three things that might be going on with him that's making it hard for him to not kick walls?
Is there a time of day that it tends to happen?
Okay.
And during the day, in the morning, at night?
During the day after school.
When mom's not home.
When mom's not home.
And there's something to do with anxiety. What else?
Okay.
So he's kind of in that space, and so is it about boredom? Is it about?
Yeah, I asked him, and he said he's not bored or tired. He just wanted to see what would happen if he
could stop. So he's got some.
There's a curiosity.
So he's got a curiosity.
Here. This is
right.
Great.
There's some impulse control.
I want to see. 11-year-old son wanted to see what would happen if he took a cleat to the wall. What would happen to the wall? Okay, so now he's taken the molding off. He's done it a couple of times. So on the one hand, you might think the problem is you have a destructive kid, right? But what's really happening underneath that destruction for this kid? Well, he could be bored. What else?
He's a building guy.
He's curious
he wants
about
to see
how things are put
things
together.
Are made, right?
Really, there's a lot of curiosity here, yes. And he acknowledged it. Anything else?
Yeah, he's got a lot of extra energy built up.
It's happening at a time of day when he's got a lot of emotional stuff pent up, so he could be trying to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
There's an impulse control issue because he thought it and then he didn't think to not do it. Medication could have worn off. He could be attention seeking. Possible. It's happening when nobody's there, so maybe, maybe not, right? But so when you, in the model that we teach, we start with taking aim, right? You're taking aim on, I'd like my son to stop destroying his room in the afternoon after school. Fair? Then we look and we get curious. What could be going on? You're looking at it from, I love that he said to you, I wanted to know what would happen. Right? That makes sense. You can sort of see how he would see it that way. Right?
So if you were going to focus on that, you might be focused on solving a problem of how do I help my child to use his creative exploring brain in a way that's safe for my home.
Right?
If it's about boredom, it might be figuring out how to help him to fill up his time so that he's not doing something destructive. If it's about anxiety management, it's collaborating with him to say, what are a few things you could try when you start to get nervous or anxious? You might need to talk to him about self-awareness. Does he even know that he's doing it? So there's all these different directions we can go with, and these are the tools that we can use. First one I want to ask is, how interested is he in solving the problem? Do you have buy-in? And it may be that, you know, you need to have him fix the wall every time it happens in order to get him to buy into changing his behavior. Or maybe he likes fixing the wall. Who knows?
Well, and so the idea behind setting the expectation, and if the expectation is, like, if you destroy something, you have to clean it up or fix it or repair it or pay for it. Once it's happened once and you set that expectation, the next time it's a natural consequence. Right? You're no longer punitive. You're not coming in punitively enforcing it because you've communicated this is the expectation I have that you're not going to destroy things, and if you do, you're going to be responsible for taking care of it, right? So you don't want him to do it, and there's this opportunity for him to learn from natural consequences. If you can stay untriggered and you can stay matter-of-fact about it, and that's really key, is to come in and laugh at, oh, now look at what you've done, instead of, I can't believe you. Right.
Well, and the important thing that I would add to that is that the natural consequences may not get him to change the behavior.
Yeah.
The natural consequences may get him buy-in to help you figure out together how to help him to change the behavior. Does that distinction make sense? Because a lot of times we think, well, if he has to clean up the mess, next time he won't do it. The reality is it may be hard for him to remember not to do it.
I'm remembering one of my kids' best friends who... the brother hit the sister and then went and put himself in the timeout chair. He knew exactly what he was doing, right, and what the consequence was, and he was ready. He was willing to take it.
Yeah.
So we have time for a few more questions. Before we do, let me just say there's a clipboard going around. There's a clipboard in the back. If you'd like the slides, if you'd like more information from us, we are Impact ADHD. We have an extraordinarily robust online resource for parents and teachers. There's about 800 or plus original articles. We have a guest expert series, so many, many of the experts you've been seeing throughout the days have either articles or interviews on our website. It's a really robust resource for parents, and we would encourage you to get more information about it. And as Dr. Green said this morning, visit it. Visit it often. Use the site.
We also offer online behavior management training for parents and educators. And one of the pieces that makes it different is that everything we do includes three things: training, coaching, and support. We do that because it's not enough to just go to one of these conferences. A lot of us need help to kind of actually put the information into practice. And we get stuck. It's like you come back with 700 ideas. I have no idea where to start. I have no idea how to stay consistent. A lot of us have our own brain challenges, and that's really what makes us different in terms of our ability to help you put those changes into place.
So we're going to answer questions for about 5 minutes here, or we can stay a little longer. We're doing a book signing downstairs at 4:30 for those of you who might be interested in that. And we have a booth downstairs, so we're here for the rest of the conference if you want to ask us questions and talk to us.
So, Elaine, hang on for just a second. So yeah. Part of our commitment as coaches is to help you figure out what you're going to do from here, right? So there's four questions we ask after every session we do, whether it's private coaching, whether it's one of our group calls or a workshop we're doing. Take a minute, answer these questions for yourself. What did you focus on most in this conversation?
Was it a particular child, a particular issue? What had your attention while we were talking?
What's a takeaway? What's at least one aha that you had?
Or an insight, right?
And then what's one realistic action step? And I'm going to say one because you guys are in so many of these workshops over the next 2 days. If you take five or six things from this one, you're going to be completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
One realistic action step. And then how are you going to set yourself up for success? Is it an accountability buddy? Is it exploring a website? What do you need to do to make it easier for yourself to put some of these changes into action for yourself and for your family?
And we'll be doing an entire workshop tomorrow afternoon at 2:45 on the concept of how do you take everything you've learned at this conference and figure out before you leave here how to not leave overwhelmed. So if that appeals to you, we'll be back.
Couple yes, questions. Please.
The question is, is there such a thing as a behavior therapist that comes into your home? And the answer is yes, there is. We would argue that the best behavior therapist for your child is you, and that when you learn these pretty fundamental skills and strategies, you're the one that's creating the environment in the long term, and you're the one that's in the relationship with that child. And if you can learn how to create that environment and stay in relationship with your child, that will have a much more
longer,
profound long-term effect than another person coming in and doing it for you. So that's why we argue for, but yes, you can have behavior therapists, and sometimes they can be really, really helpful. In some places, depends on where you are. Yes?
Do you guys have any suggestions or strategies for kiddos with task initiation? So getting started, which impacts all four of those, well, except for the technology. All those other
teams
for us at home.
So the question is strategies for task initiation. What I'd say is there's a ton of strategies on the website and in the book. And a lot of what we talked about, can you go back to that wheel?
Yeah.
A lot of what we talked about, buy-in is key, right? If they're not bought into it's hard for me to get started and it's important for me to start, you're probably not going to get anything done. So task initiation starts with intention. Before they can pay attention to it, they have to have the intention to do it. And if it's just your agenda and not their agenda, they're not likely to make that a priority.
And the thing that I would add is with all of these, the expectations are going to shift. And so you may need to start with an external support from you, from someone else, to get them started and work on finding tools that they can use independently of an external person coming in that will help them get started.
All right. So last question. What?
Any of your
It's called Parenting ADHD Now, and it's in the bookstore downstairs.
And we're in the we have a booth downstairs as well if you want to come and talk to us.
Last question.
The first slide?
Oh, yes, ma'am. So I want to bottom line what you're saying, just because the room is very restless, and they can't hear as well as I can. So what I'm hearing you saying is that sometimes if a parent has wants a task initiated, particularly immediately after school, that may not be a reasonable expectation, and you may have to modify and maybe find a different time. A lot of us want them to get their homework done right when they get home because the meds are still on board. But by that point, it still may not be the best time for a kid to get it done. So you need to negotiate and collaborate with them to figure out how to help them get it done at a time that works for them. Sometimes they need that break.
All right, we need to wrap up. Eric's up next, and we want to give him space to put his PowerPoint.
I want to say thank you all for being here, for engaging, and for the work you're doing for your kids.